It's a whole lot more formal than I'm used to. I'd rather be down on the floor with you, but probably the mics and all that stuff is set up. So thanks for being here. Had a great time at the Commodity Classic, and just had a good conversation with the folks upstairs, somewhere in this building. It's a monster building, isn't it? Anyway, floor's yours. Yes, ma'am.
So, Chairman Conaway, you've talked a lot about your budget letter, the savings that you've already had in the Farm Bill, and we also heard the President talk about $1 trillion investment in infrastructure and boosting military spending. So, realistically, do each of the committee chairs, as yourself, think that you're going to not have to donate any additional offsets for the investments that the President wants to make?
Well, we'll see. We've got a great story. We just need to tell the story over and over. We'll be pitching the budget committee. We've got some advocates on the budget committee, off the ag committee, so we'll be doing that. But we're going to do the best job we can to try to hold the line where we are. But there's, $20 trillion in debt, and as you mentioned, the President's proposed a lot of new spending, and that makes a lot of balls in there at any one point in time. No one has a real good feel yet of how that his whole financial picture is going to look. I think we'll have some sort of top line look in a couple of weeks from the White House. But we're just going to keep making our story. I can't control any of that. All I can do is just keep telling the story to as many people as will listen, and to the right people. Yes, sir.
Chris Clayton, DT, and kind of following on that, there are a lot of high expectations from the groups at this meeting and others about more spending for this, more spending for that. The FMD, the MAP program, they repeated that a lot yesterday. How do you expect to meet expectations? Do you expect to kind of lower them as you're moving along?
Well, as I don't know if you heard my last comments upstairs a while ago, I've been on a two-year honeymoon with production agriculture. Everybody loves me. They all give me hugs and kisses and standing ovations because I haven't done the Farm Bill. I haven't had to cope with those exact questions. What I do ask folks, if they've got some sort of a new program or they do specifically have requests for more money, is like, all right, who are you going to take it away from? Because if we got what we ask in the budget, it's flat, and that's going to require swapping around from where it currently is at. So I anticipate those are going to be some really difficult decisions to make and hard choices. But I raised my hand and lobbied to get this job, and I want to be the guy that's helping make those decisions. So we'll see where we go. But when people have new things, I do ask them, well, who are you going to take the money away from? If we just get what we got in 14, how's that going to work? So, yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ken Root from Iowa. We don't have a Secretary of Agriculture, and yet there's a lot of activity that's going on about trade and other things. There were 22 people, as I understand, put forth to be screened for Secretary of Agriculture, and now the one that they have picked appears that he is having some scrutiny. Can you tell us how you feel as the chair of the House Ag Committee about not having a Secretary of Agriculture yet, and anything you can add on when you think that's going to take place?
Well, sooner rather than later. I think Mr. Perdue is going to make a terrific Ag Secretary. He brings some good credentials to the table. He's a veterinarian by trade, a grain merchant also, and as well as having been governor of a state where agriculture is a big deal. So he has been an executive working with constituents who are living whatever the farm, whatever's going on in production agriculture. So he's got some good credentials in that regard. And the conversation I've had with people who worked with him, Austin Scott and Doug Collins, were both in the state Senate when Sonny was governor. And they say, he's a guy we can work with. He can be hard-headed. He makes his mind up, But he'll listen, and he's an affable guy. And so sooner than rather than later. The spigot's beginning to open up a little bit. They've had three or four done this week. We're hopeful Sonny gets done quickly. He needs to have Roberts needs to schedule his hearing, confirmation hearing, and then it would go to the floor. And I don't have I haven't talked to Pat in the last couple of weeks as to when he might think that's happening. But we need one. I know that the folks I talk with at USDA are anxious to get a leader in to be able to say what the next, what is going to be his vision, her vision, moving forward. And so the time is of the essence, quite frankly.
Now, I'll have one thing.
Sure.
Do you know of any scrutiny he's under? That's the White House for putting his name forward.
Well, he's been put forward. He's filling out the paperwork. He has extensive business interests, and those require disclosure, and the FBI has to do a background check. All of that, as he was one of the later ones announced, than in the queue making that happen. And I don't have any granularity on it other than just the mechanics of knowing that, and I don't know whether he's got his paperwork, all of it in yet, but I think that was the holdup rather than any kind of a negative scrutiny, because I think that he should be very really uncontroversial, quite frankly, and just should move through the process very quickly. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, if you take the Title I of ARCA PLC, if you copy and paste that to the 2018, you would have a safety net with the Olympic average that would be below the cost of production. And the February prices that we've received the profit sets are below the cost of production, especially in corn. So how do we approach a new bill knowing that the Olympic average would give us a safety net that's just a few inches off the ground?
Yeah. Well, first off, stacks won't work. And I've got to get cotton back into Title I, so that's already one change we'll have to make. Both those programs, the ARC program and the PLC program, had distinct kind of missions to do. One of the missions that the ARC program was not effective on was a long-term down price, you know, long-term price reductions, and that was told to those folks that wanted that program in 14. And so looking forward to having, I know that the policy group for this, for these four commodities meets this afternoon. They're gonna need to tell me what they wanna do, how they wanna move forward on this thing. And the quicker they can get that done, then the sooner we can begin those evaluations to try to make it happen. I don't have you an answer right this second, other than we're all in this together. The 14 Farm Bill was put together with, you know, giving farmers a lot of choices. Sounded good at 14. It didn't sound all that great in 15 and 16 when they had to actually make the choices. But we're going to work with the programs and address those issues. We've got a couple other things. The county variability under ARC is got to be dealt with. But the fact that, you know, if you look at the projections going forward, it does look like the current program would work under the where we are right now with prices. Great question, but I need them to start helping us solve that. There's nobody better to solve it than the folks you're living in, quite frankly. Yes, sir.
I believe you said this morning that President Trump has said he would like to have the farm bill done on time.
Yes.
And I've never heard that before, and I'm wondering, can you provide any context for that?
We'll get you the reference that came from one of my guys, but I'll get that to you.
Okay.
And he wants a strong one.
And wants a strong one.
Yeah. So we'll get you that. We'll get you that quote. Who else? Oh, yes, ma'am. Well, yeah.
And then, if it isn't possible, what alternatives could there be for that, or is there any other alternatives?
Yeah, you know, Collins quoted as saying, he said the other day in our hearing, he wants to move the acreage back up to 40 million. I don't know if we ever had 40 million in the program, but that is one of those wishes and perspectives that's going to be addressed as we go through this. And, you know, obviously Collins got a seat at the table being the ranking member, so he's an important voice in that regard. All of our programs, we'll look at them. The subcommittees on conservation and forestry have already had one of their subcommittee hearings, and we'll go through the programs like we've done with every farm bill to see what can be done to address the new circumstances we find ourselves in. And you know, Collins, one of his priorities is that. So we'll see. What's that? Well, I'm not in the business of negotiating against myself, so we'll see where we go with it and what's possible, because in all likelihood it'll be a closed loop, and so you take money away from one to increase there, those kind of things. So we have to where does Collin want to get the money to put in CRP? To who's he taking away from, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have that answer from him yet, so we'll see. Yes, sir.
Joe Gill from Minnesota. Any idea on the dairy side of things? We see a lot of farmers who are not even going into the program because they're not seeing anything
right
out of the program. What's your feeling on that?
No, I think cotton and the dairy program and the ARC county issues, or three, will have to address those along with others. But yeah, dairy's got pretty busy with many of the dairy producers. They're coming with some specific ideas. I think they'll have a program where the processors and the producers are going to be on the same page for what we want to get done. You know, we're looking at a variety. We have some good testimony. Looking at a variety of things that will make that program work better for them. There's some specific things with the way that there was. I think there was a 10% haircut on the input cost. It was just I think it was just a budget issue in 2014. But yeah, we're going to get that addressed, and that's one. Colin has two big priorities: the dairy first, and then the conservation piece. I've got to get cotton back into Title I, and so those will be a part of the drivers as we move this thing forward. But yeah, we're going to work with the dairy folks. Had a good meeting yesterday with yesterday morning with some of the dairy people, and they're pretty united on what they want to get done. And we'll just have to see what we can do once we get the numbers, get the money that we're going to have to work with, see where we can go with that. Yes, sir.
Will it be able to keep nutrition with the farm bill, or will it be a big move to have two separate bills?
That's a process question. It's not policy. I'm driven to get them both renewed on time. And if the least resistance is to keep them together and get it done, we'll do that. If the least resistance is to separate them and get them done, I'll do that. The only people I hear talking about wanting to separate them are the ones who want to defeat the farm bill. They're not going to defeat SNAP. They think they can beat the farm bill. And as I told the crowd just a few minutes ago, I was particularly uninterested in that, in defeating my own bill. So whatever works the best, we'll do. We'll get it done, but we'll get it done and on time. But that's just process. That's not a policy issue per se. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, ma'am, I can't hear you. Yep. I was in a conversation with one of Mr. Trump's top economic advisors 3 or 4 weeks ago. When it came my turn to talk, I said, look, we need to talk trade because it's vital to production agriculture. So you've walked away from TPP. Most production agriculture thought that was good, except for rice and tobacco. And so we now know what a good deal looks like. We're anxious to see what, on those bilateral deals, how much better they will get than TPP, because we now have a standard by which to gauge the new programs by. When are you going to start? How quickly get this done, et cetera, et cetera? Well, he didn't know those answers, of course, because one, they don't have their trade rep confirmed yet, so all those, that team's not yet to be in place. But time is of the essence. China is not standing on the sidelines while we get our act together. They're going to move forward with whatever deals that they get done, and to the extent they can cut us out, they will certainly do that. And so it's you know, soon. The only thing he did say one thing though that made me feel better, and that is most of the focus on trade, the trade deficits, had been on imports, and that the folks at the White House had suddenly discovered that exports play a role in the trade deficit, and they don't want to do anything to screw up the exports. So we'll continue to work with them and push on it, but be that, you know, create some whatever echo chamber I can to say, hey, we got to get trade done, got to get it moving sooner rather than later, because of the impact it has on it. That gets rolled up in the tax reform deal we're doing, the threats from Mexico that they're not going to import our corn, all those kind of good things. That uncertainty is not doing any of us any good. And so the quicker we can right, wrong, or different, understand what it is we're going to be dealing with, then the better able way that our producers will be able to cope with whatever that new reality is. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, two questions here. Direct payments. Has that trade passed? Has the public perception of direct payments pretty much?
I'm not sure what that is. What's a direct payment?
Well, the direct payments.
That's a joke.
The second part of this is, as a CPA, you're already hearing this. There are not many smiles around the floor because of finances at home. So will you address that as well?
Yeah. Yes, direct payments are they're good for the history books, but that's not coming back. There wouldn't be the kind of support we'd need to make that happen. And there's not a lot of smiles because times are hard. You guys know the numbers, 50% drop in net farm income since 2013, the worst drop since the Depression. It's not as bad as it was in the mid-80s, which is kind of the gold standard for agriculture wrecks, mainly because interest rates are way low versus where they were in the 80s. And so we've been sheltered a little bit from the impact of this downturn in terms of bankruptcies and other things because the interest rates are low and trying to keep working with that. But it speaks to why we need a farm bill. In 14, it was hard to argue. There were folks asking, misguided, we were asking, why do you need a safety net? Look at this, look what production agriculture is doing, $7 corn and all this kind of good stuff. Why do you need a safety net? Yeah, well, prices will go down. No, prices are never going down again like that. They're at a new floor. Well, that was wrong. So in 18, we'll have a much better backdrop, as miserable as that backdrop is, to be able to point to say, here's why we need this safety net. Here's why it's important to keep the producers in business. But I also want to point at the beneficiary of all of our programs. You can love our current farm bill or hate it, but it delivers the most abundant, safest and affordable food and fiber supply of any developed nation in the world. Think about that. Here's a stat for you. The top 20% of the economic ladder in this country spends more on food than the bottom 20% makes in disposable income. So I'm not worried about the top 50%. Whatever food costs, they're going to be fine. You could add thousands of dollars with it. That bottom, folks, that bottom 50% is different. And so getting them enlisted and telling members from non-agriculture backgrounds why we need this farm bill, why this safety net's important, it's their pocketbook. They get a deal every time they go to the grocery store. They get a deal when they go to the restaurant. They just don't know it, and they certainly don't know why they're getting that. So as we look at all these changes, one of my arguments will be, whatever we're doing, the current system, bless you, the current system delivers the most affordable food supply in the developed world. Why screw that up? Why arbitrarily, capriciously add the cost to the cost of food? Think about this. Remember the GMO arguments we were having? There were estimates that it would be $1,000 a family if we didn't get that fixed. There's no one in this room that $1,000 added to your food bill would really bug you probably. But average food stamp recipient gets $130 a month. Times four is $520. So you add $80 a month to that family's food bill. No new food, no better food, no for what? So as we look at these changes or proposed changes or eliminations or whatever you want to call it, what's it do to the cost of food? That single mom out there who's trying to cope, living paycheck to paycheck, maybe not on food stamps, but in that above that, but still paycheck to paycheck, her food budget's where she flexes. Her rent doesn't change, her house payment, her car payment doesn't change. If something unexpected comes up in the month, it comes out of the food budget. I don't want to make her life any harder. It's hard enough as it is. And so whatever we do, the current system, with hard work, sweat equity, risk taking, and yes, a safety net that comes steps in when times get like they are right now, is an important part of that affordable piece, and I don't want to screw that up. Make sure everybody gets one. You've had one. Okay, back at you. Yes, sir.
We're following that same, you mentioned in your remarks today that Speaker Ryan is talking about welfare reform. I smell a pile. The farm bill is ready to go. You're ready to ride with 17 or 18. But nutrition is such a big part of the farm bill, but it gets tied up in that big train of welfare reform, and we have to wait. Can you flesh that out a little bit more about what?
Well, I can't flesh it out as the terms of what we'll do. What I can tell you is what I'm bringing to the table is that I'm not going to want to allow that to stop us getting this done on time. So however we have to fold it in with whatever Paul Ryan wants to get done, because his boat's loaded, quite frankly, with tax reform and health care and everything else. Is the welfare thing is kind of a vision for 18, so not a lot of meat on that bone yet. But we've got meat on our bone. We're going to move this thing forward, and I don't know yet how we feather those together and make that move. So I'm going to be uninterested in slowing our process down to wait on that, whatever that is that Paul wants to get done. And this is one of his deeply held long-term goals, is to do something maybe similar to 96. I don't know if it'll be that expansive or not, but he's not articulated that yet because, quite frankly, as I said, there's a lot of other things going on. But my bias will be to not let that happen, to figure out whatever we need to do to keep our piece of it moving. If we have to do the farm safety net fix for SNAP and then whatever other legislation follows on to get to catch up with us, we can do that. I'm wide open to that, but I'm not gonna sit back on and wait unless I just have to, because we got to get our work done, and we're gonna be ready to make that happen. Yes, sir.
Yes. What are your views on the proposed border adjustment tax?
The view is keep your powder dry until you see the full tax package in its entirety. You really don't have a way to compare it to what's going on, because what happens if you pull a piece out, you cherry pick a piece out, we typically in our minds compare it to the existing scheme. So once the language is released from joint tax and it starts working at the committee, then CPAs and other financial professionals will be able again to be able to prepare projections to show you, here's what you look like on your current scheme, all in, here's what you look like on the new scheme. And at that point in time, you'll have enough data to be able to say, all right, as a package, I like that whole deal. There may be some individual things in there you don't like, but as a package. One of the great things that Kevin Brady does is when confronted by this, people say, well, that's great, but just don't do away with Section 1031 like-kind exchanges, or don't do away with that deduction or that credit. That shows you just how hard tax reform is, because every one of those complicating features of our code has some interest group that loves it. Somebody is using it in their tax return and they don't want to not lose it, right? And so what Kevin says is, look, it's a dial. So if I set the rate here, I've dialed everything to where it's at. So if you want to add back like-kind exchanges, I'll move that dial up, the rate goes to 20 and a half or 21. If you want to add in those deductions, well, 22. So whatever it is you do with what you want to put back into the package, it's a piece of that that has to go, the tax rate that we're going to try to get to has to go back up. And so keep your powder dry on the overall package. The border adjusted tax is by itself, I don't really fully understand yet how it's going to, CPA, I'm thinking compliance, how to put it on the tax return, all this kind of good stuff. So I don't know the mechanics of that yet, but I would just ask to keep your powder dry so that you can look at it in its entirety. You still may hate it, still may say no, but it would be a fairer piece than to try to pick out pieces of it at this stage. Yes, sir.
As chairman of that committee, one thing that's very important to farmers is, as we deal with the state taxes and the tax situation, to retain stepped up basis. That may not come out of the ag committee, but it come out of tax reform. That's very important to farmers if we want to try to transition to the next generation.
Yeah. Clearly, if you could only get one, you'd want to do away with your state tax altogether. I clearly understand the advantages of stepped up basis whenever it is you decide to get out of farming. But if you want to stay in farming and you want to hand it down from generation to generation, you'd rather do away with the estate tax. In that dial that Kevin's got, I don't know what happens with the stepped up basis. If you leave the stepped up basis in there, then you got to raise the rate. If you drop the stepped up basis and you've got half the normal rate on capital gains, that kind of stuff, you don't know where you are. But clearly doing away with the estate tax is in every single tax reform package that I've seen and is one I'm fully supportive of. I would support keeping the stepped up basis. I don't know what that does, how he's counted that in the rates that they're quoting. So, but doing away with the estate tax would be it'd be the first big step. Yes, sir.
The question is about how do you balance designing a farm bill for everybody? Farmers in the Midwest have told me personally that historically the farm bill was either weighed heavily for the southern farmers or heavily for the Midwestern farmers. You're from Texas, Sonny Perdue's from Georgia. There are folks that are maybe wondering how you're going to balance.
Sure.
Constructiveness.
No, I hear you. Very gently. I understand the perceived biases that would be built into just where I'm from, where Sonny's from, all those kind of good things. All I can do is commit to you that while cotton is an important product for me personally in the district that I get to represent, I'm going to try to be as even-handed and non-parochial as I possibly can to get this done. And to be fair to everybody. And so as far as listening to them and being taken into consideration their particular views on these things, but every farm bill has had that issue. Everyone, I mean, it's so there's always that inter-squad scrimmaging that goes on. What I tell producer groups, as I said this morning and others, there's going to be a lot of family arm wrestling going on when we get the number, we start that process. And it's going to be you know, I'm going to have to remind you from time to time, you used to like me back before we started that process. But once that does happen and we agree to that, then everybody needs to go shoulder to shoulder to get it done overall. But that's difficult, hard. It's not new. It's the same as always. Just, I know the Midwestern guys are anxious because I'm from Texas and Sonny's from Georgia and peanuts and cotton and all those kind of good things. But I hope I'm not that parochial to not be the ag chairman for everybody, all sectors of production agriculture.
Just to follow up on that point, sir, in the conversations with Sonny Perdue, is there any indication that the Trump administration is going to want to weigh in with their own kind of on-the-ground proposals, or do they understand that this is?
I've had no such conversation with Sonny. It's premature. He's going to try not to do anything to screw up the confirmation process by being really quiet. It'd be inappropriate, I think, for me to ask him anything like that. I certainly share it with you, and I haven't asked him. So, as soon as he's in, absolutely, we're going to see.
Do you want the administration to weigh in like the way the Bush administration did, or more like the
Obama? You mean when President Bush vetoed it twice, that kind of weighing in?
No. The Johann proposal
we all have our equities, and we're all jealous of those equities. And one of the equities of the legislative branch is to write the law. So, yes, ma'am.
Along that line, one of the things that would seemingly make your task a little easier is if you could get cottonseed declared as an eligible oil seed.
Right.
Is there still a path forward that maybe some of the new folks at USDA might look at the interpretation a little differently than Secretary Vilsack?
We're looking for that, looking at if there's a legislative fix in the meantime. I mean, the cotton folks are, they got bailed out this year in a sense by having monster yields, but that's a hard policy to put in place that every year you get monster yields and the price moderated just a little bit. So we've got to try to figure that out. But that would be something I'd be open to is once Sonny's confirmed, is to having that conversation with him. Yes, ma'am.
Been some reports this week that the president and some of his trade advisors might want to try to negotiate trade disputes outside of the WTO because the president doesn't feel the U.S. is being treated fairly, or maybe that they want to pull out of the WTO altogether. Your reaction?
First off, the trade agreements are only as good as the enforcement process associated with them. You look at our enforcement action that we've taken against China, where they're spending $100 billion a year on three crops. We spend $100 billion on our title, on our safety net over 8 years or so. And so enforcement is a big deal. I really don't have an insight yet as to whether or not getting in or staying in or out of the WTO. We've won as many cases as we've lost at WTO. It's a court. Obviously, losing the cotton thing has jammed us up in a kind of meaningful way over the last several years. But I don't have a position yet on what they might or might not do in with respect to that. But enforcing them, wherever the levers of enforcement are, then we need to use those levers to protect American consumers and American producers by extension, so that because the other folks are going to use those levers to try to force us to do what we need to get done, and we ought to be using them aggressively in that regard. Yes, sir.
Listening to some of your some of your meetings, you sound very confident about getting this thing done and done on time. I guess my question is, where's your confidence? And can you share a little perspective on, is it just the fact that we make some tweaks rather than rewrite this thing? Or where's your confidence in getting this thing done on time? Because it's traditionally pretty wild.
Yeah. Most of it comes from it's the right thing to do. I can't find one person who says, no, I really like the drama of an expiration. I like the drama of a short-term extension. I like the drama of a permanent law coming back. So it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing for a lot of reasons. Eliminating the uncertainty of all that, putting together a five-year plan that producers and bankers and others can look at to say, so it's the right thing to do. It will not be as complicated in terms of new stuff as it was in 14. We're talking about dairy and the ARC and PLC, fine-tuning those and seeing how they worked or didn't work. Obviously, the stacks is the one folks thing that we'll jettison and try to get cotton back into Title I in some form or fashion. In all likelihood, it'll be seed versus lint. But yeah, it there's now I've complicated it from 14 by this two-year look at the SNAP program. And 14, we just kind of snuck up on the SNAP changes. We didn't lay the groundwork. We've now laid the groundwork with 17 hearings on what we need to do with SNAP, what's working, what's not working. And we put out a paper in December. This will be the guide. So we'll have more fulsome reforms to propose on SNAP than in the past. So that might offset the lack of complications, in fact, on the Farm Bill side. So stay tuned. But, you know, every chairman who's ever stood here has said they're going to get done on time, and I'm just driven to do it. I'm a CPA. I start my meetings on time, as you know. We're gonna get this done. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, the Energy Committee Chair and one of the subcommittee members of Township has talked about a rewrite of the RFS. That's their committee, not yours. But if you had to chime in, would you have suggestions for that, especially given like some of the rhetoric that has gone on this past week?
Don't know about the rhetoric for this past week, but my view on that, and I've had some conversations with Colin and some other folks, in this kind of that Wisdom of Solomon deal, we put in place a federal program that incentivized and encouraged people to invest hard dollars in a plan that they thought was going to be there forever. And so eliminating the mandate altogether would be disrespectful of that in a sense. So what I would propose to do is that we cap the mandate at some number, probably where we are right now, and that way it respects the investments made in ethanol, and that ethanol would be used, and those folks could harvest their investment the proper way, and then any growth in that market would be free market, and let the market drive that. So if somebody else wanted to build ethanol plants, they could, but they would know it wouldn't be to meet a demand that, quite frankly, can't be met. Cellulosic ethanol is not going to come online. That was going to be the bracket between where we are and where we the 36 billion gallons. It's not going to happen. So we're going to have to do something with that. And so capping that mandate at where we are kind of gets everybody mad at you, and nobody's going to kill you, right? Because the free market guys get the free market forward. The guys who invested in it and have legitimate reasons why that they ought to stay get to stay. Well, so it's a bit of a kind of a half step, but I think that would work to move forward. Yeah, that was one I don't have a position on yet, but just the overall mandate, and I know that 15-10 versus 15 would play into that what you're using piece, but that's probably part of that discussion and negotiating and arm wrestling that would go on to finally get to a point where we eliminate the mandate beyond a certain point, sorry, a certain level, and keep it below that. That piece would be a part of that negotiation. Yes, sir.
There's been talks about RFS reform for quite a while, so it's kind of a two-parter on this. I mean, why is the environment any different now that might actually lead for something to happen? And kind of the second part on that, would you and kind of the other people on the reform side of the argument be open to extending congressional statutes past 2022 as part of a compromise on
that? Yeah. I think there's a fine that starts getting levied against refiners in 2018. That's got to be addressed because it doesn't exist. Cellulosic ethanol is not going to exist. New administration, new look at all of these kind of things that are going on right now versus what's been there in the past. So I think there's an impetus to see if we're not going to get to 36 billion gallons, and we're not, then that means EPA every year has to go work their magic to prevent all the nonsense from happening. So let's fix that. But 2018 is there. On extending it beyond 22, I assumed when we kept it at whatever that mandate was that it would be extended beyond that, but we'll see how that works out. That's part of the negotiation for moving that to 2030 or whatever it is, just to make sure that the refiners who invested as a result of the program, a federal program being in place, thinking it was going to be there forever, that they could harvest that. But that piece would be like the 10-15 would be part of the negotiation as well. Yes, sir.
At EPA, what's your take on Administrator Pruitt this first couple of weeks, and you know, maybe comment on the bonus rollback?
Yeah, excited about Scott being over there. I don't think he's been there a full 2 weeks, but excited about him. I think he's going to bring a good perspective to that job. Obviously, the Waters of the U.S. Coming unwound and starting over is the right answer. It's the answer we've been asking for. If, in fact, there's need for clarity of positions under the Clean Water Act. The WOTUS thing didn't do it. You know, the whole idea there was to simply clarify existing stuff that's going on. Nobody in their right mind today could defend WOTUS as actually having just done the clarification piece. So the start over is a good deal. And I think on balance, I'm hopeful what you'll see, not only from EPA but other regulators, is that a better relationship with the regulated. And by that I mean we're going to have regulations. You know, God starts off with 10 and we've just been adding to them since then. But they ought to make sense. Who said CPAs aren't funny, right? Finally got it. They ought to make sense. They ought to be done in a cost-efficient manner. They ought to allow the regulated to comply and as cost-efficient as they need to be. And then they go away when they've lost their usefulness. And so the first step when you're being regulated, I would hope the regulator would come in and say, all right, here's the rules. We want you to voluntarily comply with these rules. How can we help you get your systems in place and voluntarily comply with it, rather than what I perceive the Obama administration doing is coming in with a subpoena or a fine or a bullying tactic that they were trying to make sure they had the attention of the regulated. I'm hopeful to see a sea change in that attitude, so that, yeah, if you finally bow your neck and don't obey the rule, then, yeah, you're going to be fined or whatever it is, the appropriate circumstances. But the first step with the regulator and regulated ought to be, all right, we're going to have these rules. You'll have input in how the rules are developed. Then once the rules are put in place, can we help you get to voluntary compliance, which is a much better deal. So that's an attitude change that I'm hopeful to see and beyond just EPA. Last one? All right. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.
This does not count as a town hall. Oh, yes.